Local News, Culture, and NPR.
Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, Resorts World Catskills is betting big on its future, backed by a new $500 million deal. But not everyone thinks it's a winning hand for Sullivan County. A special report from Radio Catskill's Genevieve Hartnett coming up. Today marks 24 years since September 11th. With a new generation growing up with no memory of that day, the 9/11 Memorial and Museum's mission is more urgent than ever. Radio Catskill's Patricio Rubio speaks with the museum's president about remembrance and passing the lessons of 9/11 to the future. From a server room to safeguarding history, Chuck Henry's accidental IT job has turned into a statewide mission to bring nearly 15 million pages of New York's local newspapers online, plus Honesdale's free block party movie night, and remembering the late Bill Vannevar. That's coming up. First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Authorities in Utah have held a news conference to discuss yesterday's shooting death of conservative activist Charlie Kirk. Utah's Commissioner of Public Safety, Bo Mason, says officials have an idea of what the suspect may look like.
We do have good video footage of this individual. We are not going to release that at this time. We are working through some technologies and some ways to identify this individual. If we are unsuccessful, we will reach out to you as the media and we will push that publicly to help us identify them. But we are confident in our abilities right now and we would like to move forward in a manner that keeps everyone safe and moves this process appropriately.
Authorities say they believe the suspect is a person who is college age. They say they've recovered the weapon used in the shooting. It is a high-powered bolt-action rifle discovered in a nearby wooded area. President Trump is at the Pentagon this morning speaking at the September 11th memorial service. One of the four planes used by militants crashed into the side of the Pentagon 24 years ago. The attacks killed nearly 3,000 people. Stocks opened higher this morning as the Labor Department reported an uptick in inflation last month. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained about 438 points in early trading.
Consumers paid higher prices last month for groceries, gasoline, and other goods. The overall cost of living in August was up 2.9% from a year ago. That's a bigger annual jump than the previous month, and stubborn inflation may complicate the Federal Reserve's calculation as it considers cutting interest rates. The central bank is still widely expected to lower its benchmark rate by a quarter percentage point when policymakers meet next week. The Fed's in a tight spot, though, as it faces both rising prices and a sagging job market. In a separate report, the Labor Department says new applications for unemployment benefits jumped last week to their highest level in almost 4 years. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
Officials in Poland and with NATO say they are awaiting the results of a military assessment. They have not yet decided on a response to more than a dozen Russian drones that flew into Polish airspace early yesterday. NPR's Rob Schmitz has more.
Polish authorities say they found the wreckage of several drones. All of them were the Shahed-style attack drones Russia uses in its attacks on Ukrainian cities. A spokesperson for the prosecutor's office in Lublin, a city near Ukraine, says the drones found so far were unarmed so-called dummy drones used by Russia to fool Ukrainian air defenses. Russia's defense ministry said it had not planned to hit any targets in Poland and suggested that Poland was out of range of its drones, which is not true. The incursion has reignited safety concerns over the vulnerability of civil air transport in Europe. It was the first time in the history of NATO that alliance fighter jets engaged enemy targets in Allied airspace. Rob Schmitz, NPR News, Berlin.
You're listening to NPR News from Washington. British Prime Minister Keir Starmer has fired his ambassador to the United States. This is over links to late sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. NPR's Lauren Freyer has more from London.
Even after Jeffrey Epstein was indicted, Peter Mandelson, then a top center-left British politician, wrote him a 2008 email saying, quote, "Your friends stay with you and love you." Photos have also emerged of Mandelson in a bathrobe at Epstein's home, and a birthday message in which Mandelson called Epstein his best pal. The British Foreign Office says emails show the extent of Mandelson's relationship with the late sex offender was materially different than what was known at the time he was appointed as ambassador. Mandelson's sacking complicates Starmer's efforts to build bridges with the Trump administration, just days before the U.S. president comes here for a state visit. Lauren Freyer, NPR News, London.
Colorado authorities say a teenager shot and wounded two other students yesterday at his high school outside of Denver. The student then took his own life. One of the wounded students remains in critical condition. There's no word of a possible motive for the shooting. California Governor Gavin Newsom says the Trump administration is going to stop letting motorists in electric vehicles and other clean cars use carpool lanes. The change takes effect October 1st across the country. California Governor Newsom says that means carpool lanes will only be reserved for vehicles carrying more than one occupant. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Doris Duke Foundation, which aims to support the well-being of people and the planet for a more creative, equitable, and sustainable future. And listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. Now, a special report on what's happening with Resorts World Catskills in Monticello, New York. Since its inception in 2018, the casino has been losing money, and it's facing even more competition on the horizon as more casinos potentially open up downstate. A new LDC was formed as a nonprofit on behalf of Sullivan County to continue development of the property. The Sullivan County Resorts Facilities Local Development Corporation, created by the county's Industrial Development Authority, hopes to issue more than $500 million in bonds to buy the entire Resorts World property except for the casino itself. That includes an 18-story hotel, a smaller neighboring hotel, restaurants, an event center, and golf course. Officials say the transaction will boost the casino's positive impact on jobs in the county. But some residents are wondering, with an ongoing housing crisis and significant job losses elsewhere in the county, are the sprawling casino, golf course, and hotel what should be getting a shot in the arm? Radio Catskill's Genevieve Hartnett is reporting on the story, and she spoke with Jason Dole yesterday on the Local Edition.
So the Resorts World Catskills Casino was built in 2018 in Monticello. It is one of four that was actually approved in a 2013 amendment to New York state law to allow gaming in upstate New York, to allow casino gaming in upstate New York. And it was brought to the Catskills basically on the promise that it would create more union jobs, that it would bring more economic development into the county. Unfortunately, it has been seen to do very much not that. SEC filings have shown it losing money pretty handily in the 6 to 7 years that it's been open. And while it did create about 1,400 union jobs, in 2019, its owner, Empire Resorts, actually petitioned for it to no longer become a publicly holding company, as it, quote, no longer believes that the company can become financially self-sustaining as a standalone public company. And it should be noted that around that time, the Malaysian gaming giant Genting Malaysia, this is when they invested about 49% in the stock to try to revive it.
Yeah, and could you just explain to me a little bit of the significance there of what that means that they were saying, you know, you can't necessarily stand as a public company, but it could be a private company. What's the significance of that?
So basically, you know, it was brought in to be this economic engine for the county, but a lot of people question whether a international corporately held project is going to be transferring funds most successfully to the county, which is part of the argument of the IDA right now of why they want to make it a more county held property, more privately held.
Right. Okay. So let's talk about those steps. What is the plan? What are they putting together?
Sure. So in 2025, the County of Sullivan Infrastructure Development Agency, or the IDA, they created the Resort Facility Local Development Corporation. And this was its role in the Resorts World transactions were to finance and hold ownership of non-gaming entertainment-related assets of the casino, while Resorts World will continue to manage those businesses, the gaming aspect, and operate the casino. So the major parts of, but in August, they agreed to put in, basically issue over $500 million to buy out the entertainment assets of the casino. So this includes the hotel, this includes the Monster Golf Course, as well as the Alder Hotel and Entertainment Village.
So basically, this local development corporation is acquiring a lot of the assets, but not the gaming assets, meaning not the casino aspect of the casino, the actual gambling machines and tables and things like that. Is that right?
Correct, yes.
Okay, so what does that do for the county?
So the county is arguing that this will be a great way to bring in even more union jobs. And even though Sullivan County faces a housing crisis right now, I spoke with legislator Matt McPhillips, who is also the head of the economic committee for Sullivan County. And he also hoped that this could be a way that potentially affordable housing could be built around the casino, although the IDA and the Resorts Facility Local Development Corporation have not indicated any such plans as of yet.
This kind of sounds like Sullivan County is bailing out the casino here in Sullivan County. Is that what's going on?
Well, it's certainly with the numbers, and many people in the community are receiving it that way. If you look on the Sullivan County Post Facebook groups, many people are questioning why this is the priority when this year we have the Frito-Lay manufacturing arm leave the county, as that left a lot of people out of work, as well as the Gateway Housing Project, which we've continued to report on at the station. However, legislator McPhillips maintains that this is not going to be paid for by taxpayers. The IDA has stated in their August 2025 activity report that it will be payments to the Resorts Facility Corporation will be funded by a general tax on the territory.
Okay, and actually we have a clip from when you interviewed Matt McPhillips for this article, so let's play that now.
I really wanted to assure the people and the taxpayers in Sullivan County that they have no stake in this deal. There's no collateral that the county or its taxpayers are responsible for with respect to this deal. This is more to allow the casino to reconsolidate, reposition itself, and really invest in this property, which has been the largest economic development project in the county's history, and we're hoping to build on that. We saw the casino come in here. A lot of jobs were created, and we want to protect those jobs. We want to make sure that the tax revenue that's generated by these businesses and the casino itself are being put to good use for the people of Sullivan County and contributing to the things that we really need here and the things that we really need to work on.
So, yeah, so the taxpayers of Sullivan County have no stake in this. I just want to clarify again. Like, so where's that $500 million coming from?
Yeah, so it's something that the community has a lot of questions on. The IDA has said that the bond will be issued by the local development corporation and that it will be paid for through a tax on the land being developed. I've tried to ask for clarification from Jennifer Flad, but that's the most clarification I have gotten at this moment.
Okay, great. So this is a complicated story. How long have you been working on this?
I found out about this basically as soon as most people in the county did, right before Labor Day weekend. The deal was announced to the community at the end of August, and it should be, the original plan was to have it done by September. However, both parties in the transaction have delayed it for finding increased legal counsel. So we will just have to wait and see, but it will likely be within the next month or 2 months that we'll be hearing a larger development on this.
So that's a time frame and the next visible steps. I'm also wondering, just because you're already seeing, at least in the public sphere on social media, response from the public, I'm wondering, will we be hearing more from the public at any hearings or legislative meetings about this? That's the next thing I'll be watching for.
Definitely. And I know that there will be a Health and Human Services Committee meeting tomorrow to address the housing project. And I will certainly be watching as well to see if something about this comes up, especially given Legislator McPhillips' desire to potentially see affordable housing around the casino. The other thing I think is important to point out is this trade-off, I would say, from the larger Malaysian gaming company is happening at the same time as they are angling for New York City licenses to expand the Resorts World New York City casino that is located in Queens, pretty close to John F. Kennedy Airport. Most of the people that have been attending the Resorts World Catskills Casino are people that are bused in from the city. And so many people are worried that if one more downstate casino is expanded, what will that mean for upstate casinos and the jobs that they have created? So that's another reason why the county sees vested interest in investing in the casino here.
It sounds like there's a race against time that even if all goes well, we don't really know how this will work out because, again, this is what we're trying to do for a casino that has been struggling pretty much from the beginning. So this is all really interesting.
Definitely, and it's definitely something I'm going to be continuing to follow as more developments come out.
Well, Genevieve Hartnett, thank you so much for doing this reporting for Radio Catskill. And this article is up at wjffradio.org. Genevieve, thank you again.
Thanks so much, Jason.
We'll take a break. And when we come back, 24 years after September 11th, the 9/11 Memorial and Museum continues to honor the lives lost and stories of courage. Radio Catskill's Patricio Rubio talks with Museum President Beth Hillman about the importance of remembering and teaching about this day to a new generation. This is Radio Catskill.
On this Old House Radio Hour, before you hire a contractor, listen to ours as we break down what you need to ask before signing anything.
If you see in diagonal cracks, that might mean that the house is shifting a little bit. The worst would be if you see a horizontal crack. That's going to be a pretty major foundation issue.
Plus, New Yorker editor-in-chief David Remnick remembers the Moscow apartment he called home. That's this week on This Old House Radio Hour.
Sunday morning at 7 on Radio Catskill.
This week on Farm and Country, we're taking a field trip to Troutown, USA. The leaves are changing, the temperatures are dropping. We sat down with Troutown flies in Roscoe, New York, to learn why the fall might be your new favorite season for fly fishing.
Sometimes the sun sets and the way the colors of the trees reflect off the water, just magnificent.
Join me, Kimberly Izar, on Farm and Country. Saturday morning at 10 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Today marks the 24th anniversary of September 11, and the 9/11 Memorial Museum remains steadfast in its mission to commemorate, educate, and inspire. With more than 100 million Americans born since the attacks or too young to remember them, the museum's work is more vital than ever. Radio Catskill's Patricio Rubio spoke with Beth Hillman, president and CEO of the 9/11 Memorial and Museum, about the enduring significance of this anniversary. She reflects on the stories of resilience and remembrance carried forward by survivors, families, and first responders, and the museum's commitment to ensuring future generations understand the impact of that day.
As the 24th anniversary of September 11th approaches, the 9/11 Memorial and Museum continues its mission to commemorate, educate, and inspire. With more than 100 million Americans born since the attacks, or too young to remember them, the work of the museum is more vital than ever. On the phone with us now is President and CEO Beth Hillman, who joins us to reflect on the significance of this anniversary, the stories of resilience and remembrance carried forward by survivors, families, and first responders. So welcome to the program, Beth Hillman.
Thanks so much for having me.
First of all, I can't believe it's been 24 years. It's crazy. But as we approach this anniversary, the 24th anniversary of 9/11, I just want to see what stands out to you most about the memory of that day that could sort of continues to resonate for you.
It's hard to believe it's been 24 years, but it's also hard to believe we have 100 million Americans who are too young to remember 9/11 themselves. So I think what sticks out for me is how important it is to connect to new generations and share with them the stories of how challenging that day was and the remarkable response, you know, the courage and the compassion, the service that was inspired by 9/11 and how people came together. You know, literally they saw people they hadn't even seen before when they realized what was happening in their neighborhoods, in their communities, especially here in the New York area, but really across the country.
Yeah, and for me, when you say that, the first thing I think is that to see how folks did come together on that day and the days after and the weeks after, the months after. It was really the first time I experienced in my life that folks came together like that, whether you're on the left side of the aisle or the right side of the aisle in politics or whatever. It seems like folks really came together to help each other, not only at the scene, at the site, but also afterwards, just comforting each other.
Absolutely. You know, we learned a lot about how to get through an attack as terrible as 9/11, how to recognize the losses that people suffered who were closest to the consequences of the attacks, including the people who came to help and then suffered consequences on their health from responding to the World Trade Center site and breathing in the dust that was toxic. And so those stories are a big part of how the history continues to evolve. So we're interested in remembrance. We want never to forget. We want to make sure people don't forget. And we're interested in continuing to learn more and understand what's happening today as a result of 9/11.
And one of those initiatives, I understand, the museum has set a goal to reach 20 million students by the 25th anniversary next year. How do you plan to accomplish this? And why does that matter?
Well, we'll do it with a lot of help from a lot of teachers and educators who want their students to learn about 9/11. Teachers across the country have told us they want to teach and they don't always have access to the materials that they need to reach their students. So we continue to do more to make that possible. We've reached 5 million students through our digital learning experience. So on the anniversary every year, we publish and make available free of charge a video that has first-person accounts, eyewitnesses, stories of people themselves, and they're deeply affected by 9/11. And that really moves people to hear those authentic stories. That's available at 911memorial.org/DLE. Like the memorial itself, which is free of charge, that's free of charge. All of our educational resources are free. And then when we students in the museum who can actually get here to the museum, it's free for students to come from the tri-state area. Our fall programs are the field trips for students. It's available online now for teachers to sign up at 911memorial.org.
Mm. Now, I understand that there is a new exhibition of children's art. If you want to talk a little bit about that and sort of how it reflects the way young people connect to 9/11.
You know, one of the things we learned from 9/11 was the consequences of that kind of harm on people over the long term and how we can best support the moving ahead. And no one was more affected than the children who lost parents on that day. Some of those children and then other kids as well, because it wasn't only those kids, but others created art in the aftermath of 9/11, guided by artists and teachers, educators, therapists who wanted to help them recover. So that new exhibition in the museum draws on that art that was created to show how people came together, how we used our understanding and we grew our understanding of how to help people respond, and how incredibly resilient children can be when facing that kind of challenge.
Right. And the story of 9/11 is ongoing. You know, nearly 25 years later, the health effects on first responders and survivors remain a major part of the 9/11 story. I think you want to talk a little bit about how does the museum honor and amplify those ongoing struggles?
It's such an important way of the way the museum has changed in recent years. We've changed the design of the Memorial Plaza to add a glade that recognizes the contributions, the sacrifices of all those folks who responded, union workers, laborers, first responders, the survivors in the community, the people who just lived here who were affected by that dust. We also have a new part of our 9/11 commemoration where we have a moment of tribute in that glade to recognize those people who have lost family members and who continue to suffer from the effects of that. There's an installation in the museum called Dust, Illness and Advocacy After 9/11 that reminds visitors of the tenacity that people fought for recognition and treatment and compensation for the people who were suffering. And for everybody who's in the World Trade Center Health Program, about 140,000 people, we offer free admission to the museum. And we try to make sure everybody knows how they, if they're eligible, can become a part of that World Trade Center Health Program, which monitors and offers treatment to the people who are suffering from health effects related to their service here.
Yeah. Now, as someone who's yourself, Beth, as someone who's leading this work, you know, I just want to know what has been the most meaningful or challenging part of ensuring that 9/11 is remembered, you know, with not only with compassion, but also accuracy.
I think getting history right is never a task that's done. I think we have to continue to fight to understand better what people went through. You know, the stories of 9/11, almost 3,000 people were killed that day. What happened and the responses is among the most compelling narratives out there, but we don't know everything about what happened that day. And each one of those people has a story of their life before that day that we also want to share with the people who visit the museum. And I think maybe hardest about being here at the Memorial Museum is realizing the emotion and the intensity that continues to affect people when they remember that day and they reckon with what it meant for them and the world that it changed so much. But definitely the best part is to see people come together. When you see the communities, the groups of family members, the first responders, the survivors, our volunteers, the people who are just in the museum witnessing and experiencing and learning themselves how classes come together around lessons like this, that's a really powerful thing, especially at this time.
Yeah. And you just reminded me, you know, just about, you know, life before 9/11 and how things changed. And you know, I lived in the city during 9/11, and I just remember how different the city was and still is. I feel like it's like after 9/11, the city's changed, and you can still see the remnants of that with security that's going on, how buildings have adapted to secure themselves, and you know, just how the subways got more police force and more secure because of the threats from 9/11. It just seems like we still have those remnants of 9/11 in those parts.
No, that's so true. Sometimes things change in ways you don't really see, and then all of a sudden later you notice that they've changed. And sometimes on days like 9/11, it feels like everything changes all at once, and there's really no going back. The city certainly felt different after 9/11, and you're right, in many ways has continued. Those changes have not gone back. It's one reason, too, New Yorkers aren't always ready to visit us. We have free admission on the first Sunday of every month, thanks to the Carnegie Foundation, for New Yorkers who want to visit the museum who haven't had a chance to come yet. We realized that a specified time when people could come who were New Yorkers, who remember that, or who want to bring their families, we wanted to make it possible for them to come for free.
Yeah. Now, looking ahead to the 25th anniversary next year, I don't know if I'm sure there's already plans for, I know every year that there is a remembrance and you know, I hear it on the radio and watch it on TV. But looking ahead to the 25th anniversary, is there anything special planned or a kind of message that's going to be given out?
Well, remembrance and service are themes for the 25th anniversary. You know, every day in the museum is a special day for the people who encounter those stories and who visit. But 25th anniversary is a big time for a milestone anniversary for 9/11 itself. Also, America 250, a time when the country's persistence and where it is today is going to be at center stage too. And we really want to lean into the unity and the service that was inspired by 9/11. People chose to do so many things in that aftermath. Some people left. Some people didn't stay. Some obviously, almost 3,000 people were killed, but their families went on. Their children became firefighters and teachers and therapists and service members. They did all kinds of things to try to help and to contribute, and their lives were redirected. And so that's what we expect to focus on in our exhibitions and in our outreach around the 25th anniversary.
Beth, as we close this interview, what message do you hope the nation and the world carries forward about 9/11?
I think the capacity of New York City to recover is a stand-in for the capacity of the world to recover from the most challenging things. The fact that the World Trade Center is again a thriving hub of commerce and culture, the fact that people have not forgotten and that we can continue to remember, and that the World Trade Center is anchored by a memorial that's free and open to the public and a sacred space of remembrance for the people who were killed by those terrorist attacks that day. I think that's a positive message for moving ahead. And I think it's one that can make it possible for people to deal with other things that they're facing out there too.
Well, we were talking to the president and CEO of the 9/11 Memorial and Museum, Beth Hillman. Thank you so much for talking to us, Beth, about this really important time in our lives and marking the 24th anniversary on 9/11. Thank you so much. I do really appreciate it.
Thanks, Patricio. Take good care.
In Liberty, I'm Patricio Roballo for Radio Catskill.
There are several 9/11 memorial services happening throughout the region, including in Sullivan County in the town of Highland tonight at 6, Wurtsboro Fire Department and the American Legion Post in Wurtsboro at the Fieldhouse at 6:45. The Monticello Fire Department at 7, and the Town of Liberty at LaPolte Park Stage at 6. We'll take a break, and when we come back, from servers to stories, Chuck Henry thought he was just handling IT, but now he's at the helm of a project that's putting millions of historic New York newspapers online. This is Radio Catskill.
Support comes from Catskills Property Care, offering full property care year-round for commercial and residential properties in Sullivan County, including snow plowing, landscaping, property checkups, and more. Information at CatskillsPropertyCare.com. And from the Calicoon Theater, an updated vintage movie theater with new film releases, live music, and more. CalicoonTheater.com. And from listeners like you, who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Hi, Ira Flatto here from Science Friday. We view Sci-Fry as a refreshing break from the daily bombardment of political news. You know, there's lots of important and interesting science and technology out there. Whether it's the deep, dark mysteries of the universe or your deep, dark microbiome, it's all right here. So start your weekends with thought-provoking news on Radio Catskill.
Welcome back to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. When Chuck Henry was first hired for the New York State Historic Newspapers Project in 2013, he thought it would be a straightforward IT job. But his role quickly grew beyond servers and software. Henry now manages the statewide digitization effort that has brought nearly 15 million pages of local newspapers online at nyshistoricnewspapers.org. Partnering with libraries, historical societies, and museums across New York, the project scans fragile originals and microfilm reels to preserve and share small-town newspapers with the world. I spoke with Henry recently about the project and how he got his start.
I kind of came into this accidentally. I'm an IT coordinator primarily, and so when the project began for a statewide historic newspaper project in 2013, I was hired to help support the servers and the like involved with the project. And then from there, I ended up working closer with libraries and historical associations and museums across the entire state to get their film here. We here run in-house a microfilm digitization project, which is kind of the core function of this website. Everything that we scan from microfilm from all of these libraries and historical associations and museums becomes content on the site. And so I kind of became more and more an expert in not only the microfilm, but these titles and where they're from and the different parts of the state and what was interesting about that and seeing what was interesting going on in each of these parts of the state.
Your talk is called First Drafts of History. From your perspective, why do community newspapers matter so much to understanding local history?
In a lot of cases, a lot of these newspapers contain the written record of everything that was going on in that particular time period, in that particular area. And a lot of these newspapers are before news syndication. And so in a lot of ways, they're very hyper-local news items. There are lots of examples of newspapers that printed little bits about, you know, Mrs. So-and-so went to visit this other family for tea one afternoon. You know, it's these interesting little tidbits about what was going on in that time for those people.
And many folks in those towns held on to newspapers as a source of that kind of news and other news, but also as a sign of progress and identity. What does it mean today for these communities to see local papers digitized and shared statewide, even across the world?
It allows them to kind of establish like a little bit of identity that's public facing and gives them an idea of what their culture and their importance is. I think it's very easy for small towns especially to be lost in the shuffle of the large state and the large world, and online as well, be lost in the online world. And so to have these newspapers be able to provide a snippet of what makes a town special or makes that town unique, it and present it to the world is a wonderful thing.
This project involves libraries, historical societies, and museums from all across New York. You're managing the digitization process that makes these newspapers available online. How easy is it to go to nyshistoricnewspapers.org and start exploring? Can you walk us through a simple search example for maybe finding a relative or a specific event?
Absolutely. When you first arrive at the website, and you can easily find our website by searching Google, it is literally nyshistoricnewspapers.org. When you arrive there, there is a search box right on the front page, and you can go ahead and start typing a name right into that search box. From there, you can narrow down further. So if you're looking for a specific set of dates, I'm looking for a relative that was alive in the 1950s. You could start there, put their name in there, restrict it down to the 1950s. Boom, you're going to get some results. We have nearly 15 million pages from every county in the state. So it's really easy to get too many results,
yeah.
In which case from there you can start to narrow it down. You can select by county or multiple counties, and that'll narrow it down even further for you. And from there, you just start looking at what's available. We have so many papers, and there's so many interesting things to see just by clicking the links that you did in that one quick search.
What are some of the biggest challenges in digitizing old newspapers?
There are several. I mean, if you're coming from paper, as in if you're scanning the original paper, paper is very fragile, especially if we're talking about papers from the 1800s, even 1900s. So that's difficult. They're difficult to handle. They're difficult to manage. They're difficult to get good images from. The other place that we do is the microfilm digitization. And microfilm digitization requires scanning the film that a user might see if they were looking at microfilm in a library, like you see in the movies, but scanning that film to make the text legible enough. And then from there, we do optical character recognition, which is what allows us to do the actual searching. All of that needs to be just about perfect to make the text 100% searchable on the other end. And sometimes it is not. The photos of the newspapers are terrible, or the quality of the newspapers when they were photographed, either for microfilm or for digitization, was terrible. You know, old things are hard to take good photos of.
This project is massive. You mentioned the millions of pages already online. Where do you see it going, in the next 5 or 10 years?
We're going to continue collecting as many pages from as many titles as we can. We have a few counties where our coverage is not as great as we'd like it to be, and so we've begun to focus a little bit on those. There is a lot of newspapers left untouched yet. A New York State Library about 10 years ago did a project where they indexed every newspaper that they knew about in New York State. And they estimated there were somewhere on the order of 10,000 titles available in New York State. We only have about 1,000 of them. So there's a lot of material still left to be found and left to be put online.
And for folks who are listening, what would you encourage them to do after they hear this? How can they use these resources, for their own research or family stories or even community projects?
There are lots of different uses for the site. One of the big ones that we hear all the time is genealogists. Because newspapers are such a rich source of births and deaths and marriage announcements, arrests, property transfers, etc. So that's one possibility. If you're curious about your family, that's a way to go about doing it. Also, folks who are history researchers, if you are part of a local history society or a local museum and you're interested in more about what's going on or was going on in your town, that's a great way to go for it. Also, the students get a lot of use out of the site as well, because there's a lot of local history that can be easily dovetailed into New York State's history curriculum. So these are all great ways to dig in and look at these newspapers.
And finally, when you look at a digitized issue of a small town newspaper from, you know, a century ago, is there something that strikes you the most when you see that? Is it about your side of things, bringing it together with the technology, or is it, you know, just preserving these human voices?
You know, I'm always struck by how the reporters or the folks writing the articles for these newspapers really care about the community that they're writing about. You know, when we think about newspapers and media today, it's always big syndication and big news and national things. But these newspapers were ultimately about their neighbors and their friends in that community. And so the newspapers are always so well written and so generous of the humanity of the people that are in that town. And I think that's amazing.
That was Chuck Henry from the New York State Historic Newspapers Project. You can explore the millions of digitized pages for free at nyshistoricnewspapers.org. And if you'd like to hear Chuck in person, he'll be speaking Saturday, September 13th at 1 at the Gilboa Museum and Nicholas J. Juried History Center in Gilboa, New York. Chuck, thank you so much for joining us, and thanks for the great work you're doing to preserve those papers.
Thank you. Thanks, Jim.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, free block party movie night in Honesdale is coming up tomorrow. We'll find out more after this. You're listening to Radio Chatskill.
Celebrate 35 years of Radio Catskill at the Lou Beach Community House Summer Jubilee. Join us this Saturday from 5 to 8 p.m. for live music from Kala Sun and Lolly and the Pops and a DJ set by the Mixtape's Jason Tugon, plus cold beer from Catskill Brewery. Tickets are $25 and proceeds benefit Radio Catskill. More information at wjffradio.org. The Lou Beach Community House Summer Jubilee, a project of the Beaverkill Valley Land Trust.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Honesdale's fourth annual family block party is tomorrow night, hosted by the Wayne County, Pennsylvania Library and community partners. The evening kicks off at 6:30 with games and activities for the whole family, plus a big screen outdoor movie. Joining us live are Honesdale Mayor Derek Williams, Wayne County Library volunteer Aaron Gill, and movie enthusiast and volunteer Jamie Brown, who are helping organize the event. Hi, guys.
Hey, good morning.
So tell us more about Free Block Party Movie Night. What's the big movie?
Oh, Kung Fu Panda 4.
Yay! Tell us how this all kind of came about and how this tradition's been going on for the last 4 years.
Well, Tim, I think about 4 years ago, a group of us were talking, including the group that you're talking with today, about how awesome it would be to have more things going on outside, and that could be family-friendly and some alternatives to... Here in Honesdale, we don't have a movie theater, so thinking about what we can do to make some movie nights happen. And from there, we just all partnered up and made it happen.
And I mentioned it's hosted by the library there and community partners, you guys. What goes into putting this all together?
Gravity Ice Cream is willing to shut down their street and provide a rain venue as well. And then all the other businesses that are nearby also are willing to give up their parking spots for us to shut down the street. And we bring lawn games and playlists and read stories to the kids that are relevant to the movie.
Mm-hmm. Well, listen, giving up ice cream and parking, those are two big sacrifices, which makes it a good night for everybody in the community. you guys, what does it mean for you and the community? I'll kind of go around the ring there. Mayor Williams?
Yeah, well, for me, it's great to see something that everyone can go to that's free and really accommodating and accessible. A couple of years ago, as soon as we shut the streets down, one of the younger citizens here that was attending just started like running up and down them screaming like, "The streets are ours, the streets are ours." And it was like one of the most beautiful things I've experienced so far while being mayor.
Aaron?
I think one of the wonderful things about this actual event is that we get to like not just partner with Gravity, and the library loves to help out in any way because we're a nonprofit, but also the fact that we are, again, involved in our community, having kids, again, running up and down the street, but having activities like Jamie said before, you know, running playlists that have to do with the movie or reading books to kids that may not necessarily have that, you know, outlet, you know, on a fun Friday night.
And Jamie?
I just love to see all the families and community members come out and enjoy the movie, and it's a casual atmosphere. We're giving out free popcorn, and I don't know, everyone's just having a great time. Oh yeah, lawn chairs and blankets, and last year my son was cuddled up with some person, I don't even know, another little kid, like just loving life.
Yeah, and talk a little bit more about how you guys incorporate the library's mission into this free movie night and some of the other community partners that are going to be there too.
Well, I think one of the things with the library is that I'm trying to speak for Tracy, our library director, because she's not here with us, but because it's a nonprofit and we love, you know, again, helping the community in any way we can, whether it's, you know, providing the insurance in order to get the license for the movie, or just, you know, reading to the kids, or in last year I dressed up as a goose and read a book to children, which, hey, you know what? It's always a good time.
Got to do it for the children.
You got to do it for the children. That's right. I even got my tail honked on a little bit. But we have a wonderful time at this event, and it's really fun to be there. And I like to represent because I'm in education. I work for Lackawanna College as well. So for me, it's all about community and being there. I have some of my students with their children show up, and then some of my regular traditional students show up, and it's just a good time.
And can you talk a bit about how folks in the community can support the event if they want to support other than just, attending?
We're going to have a donation. We're going to have a donation jar with us. So if any little bit will help, you know, for our next year's adventure, which will be hopefully year number 5 for us.
Yeah. So just spreading the word.
Yeah.
Every year our numbers have increased a little bit, and that is, you know, the more the merrier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, everyone kind of volunteers to put this together, Tim. So any donations can just go basically to the presentation rights of the movie that the library helps us put on.
Right. Yeah, you do have to get the rights to show that movie. So the money will go back toward next year's event as well. Remind folks about this year's event, though. It's coming up tomorrow. Give folks the details.
Mm-hmm. The street will be closed down starting at 5, and we'll have lawn games out, a book reading, a dance party, kung fu fighting, of course. And then 7:30, the movie will start. We'll have free popcorn, and everyone can just run free.
And that's outside of Gravity Ice Cream on 6th Street between Main and Church Streets in Honesdale. There's more information at the Greater Honesdale Partnership's Facebook page. Anywhere else folks can find information?
Yeah, probably Facebook. You'll see things promoted on like the library page, on the mayor's office page, on Gravity Ice Cream page. Otherwise, if you're just walking around town, just follow the sounds of joy.
All right. And before we go, have you guys seen all of the Kung Fu Panda movies? Are you looking forward to this?
Yeah, I am. I'm a huge Jack Black fan. For me, this is just joy.
All right.
I think number 3 is my favorite, but we'll have to see.
We'll see how 4 does tomorrow. That's Honesdale Mayor Derek Williams, Wayne County Library volunteer Aaron Gill, and volunteer and enthusiast Jamie Brown. Thank you guys so much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Tim.
All right, we'll take a quick break. And when we come back, Bill Vannevar, the visionary behind the Vannevar Caravan, is being honored Sunday with a memorial concert at UPAC in Ulster County. Natalie Merchant, Tim Chapin, and more will take the stage. Valerie Manzi, our culture reporter, has more after a break. This is Radio Chatskill.
Scientists at Alphabet's Moonshot Factory tackle big, serious global problems, but their leader likes to show up on rollerblades, sometimes dressed as Gandalf.
It's also my way of trying to disarm people and remind them humor and silliness are very close to the wellsprings of creativity.
How Astro Teller leads scientists to their breakthroughs. Next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Friday afternoon at 1 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Sunday, Ulster County honors the late Bill Vannevar, visionary musician, composer, folklorist, and co-founder of the Vannevar Caravan. A memorial concert at UPAC in Kingston will feature Natalie Merchant, Tim Chapin, and more. Culture reporter Valerie Manzi spoke with his wife and lifelong creative partner, Livia Vannevar.
Good morning, Livia Vannevar, and welcome to Radio Chatskill.
Good morning, Valerie. Thank you for having me.
You are here to talk about an upcoming event happening this weekend that is September 14th, correct?
Yes, on Sunday, September 14th from 4 to 7 at UPEC.
Okay. And that is a celebration of the life and legacy of Bill Vannevar, and it's a tribute to his life in song. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. Well, Bill Vannevar was quite an amazing human being and musician. We had a life together for the last 54 years. He just passed away in June, and this will be marked 3 months since we lost him. The celebration is one of just commemorating his life and the music that he loved and the music that he wrote and the dance that he loved. And it will be a very packed, almost like a festival of the music and dance that he loved, featuring musicians like Natalie Merchant, Tom Chapin, Guy Davis, David Amram, Tony Trischka, and many of the dancers and musicians from our own company, the Vannevar Caravan. And it will be quite an array of musical styles and memories for the last 81 years of his life.
And can you tell us a little bit about Bill for those of us who might not be familiar with his work and legacy?
Sure. I think he was known as Billy Vannevar in the 60s. He was a kind of a banjo protege of Pete Seeger and was well known in the folk music world. When we met in 1971, we began combining dance and music of all different traditions together. So he actually started composing music based on everything from Balkan to Chinese to American music, and began composing for not only for dance, but also for film. So this concert that people will come to and really enjoy, even if they don't know who he is, or he was, rather, will be very eclectic and entertaining. There's about 50 performers in the concert, including dancers and musicians, both well-known and locally known.
And can you tell us a little bit about Vannevar Caravan that he co-founded?
Mm-hmm. We co-founded the Vannevar Caravan in 1972 with the first concert that happened in the West Village in New York City at Washington Square Methodist Church. And it is a dance and music company that's based in this area, based in the Hudson Valley. But we've been traveling all over the world, and that is one of our biggest identities, is that when we travel, we present American music to different countries and also share the music of the various cultures that we've encountered. And Bill has done amazing arrangements and compositions based on traditional music from all over. And we've shared it with people everywhere, from school projects, arts and education programs, to concerts, to festivals. It's been quite a journey, I must say. And you know, the best way to learn about Bill, learn about the Vannevar Caravan, is to visit the website, vannevarcaravan.org, where you'll see a lot of examples of the work that he created and that we created together.
Mm-hmm. That is a wonderful website, and I'm so glad that you said that, because anyone who wants to be inspired about what can happen with this type of firm commitment will be just overjoyed.
Yeah. It's very joyful work. It's very intense work because, you know, we've worked in countries that are not as well off as the U.S., and their music and dance is what keeps them going and keeps them happy and provides that for most people that I know. It really lifts our spirits, and that's what you'll see on Sunday as well. You know, it'll be a tribute to Vannevar's life, but also a celebration of hope and joy and what the arts can do for humanity.
There is also a memorial fund. Would you tell us about that? Because it was very interesting to read about all of the upcoming projects.
Yes. So the memorial fund is not only dedicated, part of the fund is dedicated to the scholarship programs that we have and the work that we do in the schools, but also to the creative work and the new projects that the company is doing. So we have one of the main things that Bill Vannevar has been doing over the last 5 years since COVID has been writing a symphony called The Nine Muses, The Nine Greek Muses. And it's a beautiful, beautiful work for an orchestra, fully orchestrated. And he completed it just about 2 months before he died. So one of the goals is to get this work out into the world. And also creating a piece called America in Motion that will celebrate the 250th anniversary of the U.S. independence, but in a way that highlights the workers of the country, the workers that made the country what it is today.
Is there anything else you'd like to add before we end?
I think just be sure to tell your friends. There are still plenty of seats left, and everybody, it will be something that everyone can enjoy. It's really there's something there for everyone. And I think the generosity of the performers that are coming to share their music, share their memories of Bill, is quite amazing. There's a lot of heartfelt and strong friendship connections with every performer that is going to be on the program. I think people will come away from the program with a real lifted heart and a real sense of community, because it's the community that's really helped to make the Vannevar Caravan what it is today after being in the Hudson Valley for over 50 years.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to speak to us about this upcoming event and about all of the wonderful programs that we can look forward to.
Thank you, Valerie, for having us.
Yes.
And thanks to culture reporter Valerie Manzi and that conversation with Livia Vannevar. A Life in Song, a tribute to the life and legacy of Bill Vannevar in song and dance, is Sunday, starting at 4. It's at the Ulster Performing Arts Center in Kingston. There's more information at vannevarcaravan.org. That's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. I'll see you tomorrow. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale, dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFRadio.org.
Hello, this is Thane Peterson, host of Living Jazz. Please join me this Saturday when Living Jazz will pay tribute to Andrew Hill, one of the greatest composers and pianists in the history of jazz. The playlist was chosen in conjunction with trumpeter Ron Horton, one of our local jazz luminaries who toured with Andrew Hill. That's Living Jazz pays tribute to Andrew Hill this Saturday at noon on Radio Catskill.
Radio Catskill, keeping you connected with the local edition. Weeknights at 6, right after All Things Considered. The local edition, only on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. We're streaming live at WJFFradio.org. Today's weather, well, that sunny, mild weather continues for the next few days. High 74 today, cloudy tonight, low of 50. Sunshine and some mixed clouds tomorrow and Saturday with highs in the low to mid 70s. And that night, lows around 50 to the mid 50s. But we'll get some rain in the forecast Sunday with a chance of some thunderstorms and showers lasting possibly through Tuesday. WJFF Jeffersonville, it's 11 o'clock.